Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 050812 State Farm Life Insurance Company versus Tony Lawson Martinez.
May it please the court. Ms. Ramos will present argument for the petitioners. The petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. State Farm is entitled to reversal of the Court of Appeals opinion for two reasons. First, the opinion causes confusion as to what the law requires of life insurers facing conflicting claims to the same proceeds. Second, the opinion penalizes life insurers who are neutral stakeholders for not adjudicating the competing claims and fashioning relief only courts can provide. Until the Court of Appeals opinion, Texas law provided clear guidance as to how life insurers facing conflicting claims that present reasonable doubt should proceed when there's no clear authority as to which beneficiary should be given the proceeds, and that is promptly admit liability to pay the proceeds to the proper recipient and then tender the funds into the court's registry as part of an interpleader action.
When?
State Farm followed the law by doing precisely that. The question is when reasonable.
When did they do the interpleader? I mean, is that a strict 60-day deadline, or would it have been different if they had interpled the funds 3 months, 5 months, 6 months down the road?
According to the case law on interpleader, the test is no unreasonable delay. And State Farm
but
did.
But doesn't the... I mean, that's the rule of all interpleaders, insurance companies or anybody, no unreasonable delay.
That's
doesn't,
right.
Doesn't, when the legislature passes a statute saying 60 days, doesn't that change it?
Well, the legislature passed a statute saying the insurance company must accept or reject the claim and pay the claim within 60 days.
Interpleader is a form of payment, though. Interpleader is a form of payment.
Interpleader is a form of payment. And I will submit to this court that from an appellate lawyer's perspective, it is certainly regrettable that State Farm did not file its interpleader within the 60 days. However, the 12 days beyond this, when the 60-day bell rang, falls within the mainstream of cases that have held no unreasonable delay. There are numerous cases that we have cited in our brief at pages 23 through 25.
Let me just separate those questions. If there's no 2155 or whatever the current article is, any interpleader, again, has got to be within a reasonable time. And assuming we were to find 72 days under these circumstances is a reasonable time, then aren't you still liable for penalty interest for the delay of the 12 days?
We submit no, because as this court said in Great American Reserve versus Sanders in 1975, that where circumstances exist that allow interpleader to be the proper remedy, such as this one, when the conflicting claims present reasonable doubt, and the insurance company does not pay the funds into the court's registry within the statutory time frame, or for that matter, before one of the claimants files a lawsuit, does not automatically make the insurance company liable for the statutory penalties and attorney's
fees. That's the question. I mean, that's one paragraph. And while I have the highest respect for Justice Pope, he doesn't really tell us why that's so.
Well, but further cases construing Sanders have told us why, and that is how much time must pass before an interpleader becomes unreasonable depends on the circumstances of the particular case.
I agree with that as far as when it's okay to interplead. But, I mean, the legislature has said if it's more than 60 days, 18% penalty interest applies, period.
What this
and aren't we kind of... I mean, doesn't Sanders, I mean, it was only 7 days there.
Correct.
But it's saying you don't get what the legislature said you do get.
Again, we have cited numerous cases in our brief that don't just apply to Article 3.62, which was in effect during this court's era of Sanders, but also apply to the the statute that was enacted after 3.62-2155, and even those cases say that where the insurance company did not interplead the funds within the statutory time frame, you look at the circumstances of the particular case, and the key is whether or not the carrier acted reasonably.
Why did the legislature change the period from 30 days to 60 days?
Most likely because it had some strong lobbyists on the insurance side that requested it to change. It also changed the penalty from 12% to 18%.
Because 30 days really wasn't enough time, perhaps, to make a determination. And so by giving 60 days, doesn't that make it a harder and faster rule? You know, we give more time to investigate now, but you know, harder to say we're going to go beyond that to find reasonable.
It does allow for more time, but as this court recently said in Duenas just last month, when the legislature is to be regarded as intending statutes, even when repeatedly reenacted, to be given that interpretation which has been settled by the courts. And the legislature, in repeatedly reenacting the prompt payment statute, should be regarded as intending that statute to be given the interpretation as been settled by this court, and that is not penalizing an insurance company.
Is any legislative history suggesting that so?
The legislative history suggests precisely this, that there has been no discussion. In fact, our law firm went to great efforts recently to listen to the House tapes. This was a House bill.
This was 91, which was huge.
Correct. The initial Article 3.62 was enacted in 1951, and then it was repealed and reenacted as Article 2155 in 1991. And there were some substantive changes made. Correct. However, none of the legislative discussions during the debates
relates to this.
Had any discussion whatsoever about interpleader. And what that means is, when you look at Duenas and the law cited in Duenas, and that is, the legislature must be presumed to intend statutes to be given the interpretation that has been settled by the courts, and that is to allow a common law interpleader exception.
This argument so far has gone sort of like the proceedings below, and that is a concentration on the time period and the delay and whether that's reasonable or not, and away from a trial court finding and conclusion of law that State Farm should not have had any reasonable doubt that Tony Watson Martinez was a primary beneficiary. And my question is, to what extent did you challenge that finding and conclusion on appeal? Maybe you can address that.
Right. Thank you, Justice Jefferson. In various ways, we preserved error on the notion that State Farm had reasonable doubt. First of all, in filing a motion for new trial, we cited Sanders to alert the attention to the court that the standard is whether or not the insurance company, when faced with conflicting claims, is presented with reasonable doubt. Secondly, in our appellate brief before the Court of Appeals, before the 10th Court, in our issue number 4 and in our argument throughout our brief, we complained and challenged all findings of fact and conclusions of law supporting statutory liability and attorney's fees. Likewise, in this court, in our issue number 4, we challenge all findings of fact and conclusions of law supporting statutory liability and attorney's fees. And under this court's opinion, in Anderson versus Gilbert, it's a per curiam opinion of 1995, that case holds, this court hold, that even under the prior point of error practice, a party does not waive an appellate point when its argument directs the attention of the court to the error about which complaint is made, even if, that, as stated by this court in Sanders, even if the party does not challenge the specific finding of fact on that point. And this is also reiterated in the new issues presented practices under TRAP 52.3 and 55.2. In fact, Justice Jefferson, the appellate court, the 10th Court, dismissed the respondent's hyper-technical waiver argument and considered State Farm's challenge that all of the findings of fact and conclusions of law supporting statutory liability were indeed in error.
How do you address the argument that the legislative acquiescence argument is harder here because the argument's being made that what your asking for maybe, depending on how you read it, in direct contravention of the statute 60-day bail, as you called it.
Quite frankly, we don't see
it. So we didn't have that in Duenas, any direct language that looked like it might be different.
I appreciate that. We don't see it as a direct contravention of a statute. First of all, you look at the statute applies to a party who is a claimant under the statute. And at the time one respondent filed her claim, she was not a beneficiary of record.
Why not?
Because the change had not been effectuated.
Well, but that's one of the problems in the case.
Right.
It's a bit disingenuous to say she's not a claimant when there's an argument made that you wrongfully rejected her as a claimant.
Well, and we certainly don't concede that we wrongfully rejected her.
I understand.
And the issue there, Justice O'Neill, is that no one can dispute, none of the parties nor any of the lower courts can dispute that the former wife, the ex-wife Linda, had an equitable interest in the proceeds. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals fully recognized these rights of the ex-wife by imposing the subject to constructive trust remedy. The very fact that the trial court's judgment recognized the ex-wife's rights demonstrates that State Farm could not have blindly accepted Ed Martinez's change request that wholly ignored the rights of the ex-wife. All agree, all parties and all courts agree that the rights of the ex-wife needed to be acknowledged. And there is nothing in the policy nor the law that requires an insurance company who is a neutral stakeholder to impose this constructive trust subject to constructive trust remedy. Only the court is empowered to impose a subject to constructive trust remedy. Yet the Court of Appeals decision would have had State Farm act as judge and jury, fashioning relief that only a court is empowered to do.
Can an insured designate different primary, more than one primary beneficiary? I want $120,000 of this policy if I die to go to this primary beneficiary.
I think quite frankly, an insured can do that, but the insured here did not. What the insured did, we have presented the court this morning with a timeline, and looking at the timeline, we presented the timeline in the way of an oral argument exhibit. Looking at the timeline, what happened is, insured Ed Martinez, on August 1st, 2002, he submitted a change request asking that his current wife replace his ex-wife as beneficiary, making no mention whatsoever of the ex-wife's rights. What's critical to note here, and this is a part of the court's record at 656, insured Ed Martinez knew how to remove his ex-wife's irrevocable beneficiary status because he did just that with respect to a separate $175,000 State Farm policy. What he did there was he submitted a change request with the ex-wife's express consent, who signed off as irrevocable beneficiary. Quite the contrary, with respect to the change request on the $500,000 policy, his change request made no mention whatsoever of the ex-wife. It simply said, name my current wife, Tony, who's the respondent in this cause, as beneficiary. So what State Farm did is returned his change request, saying, we can't process this change because it appears to be prohibited by a divorce decree.
But your policy says that it becomes effective when you signed, sent, on an applicable form, and it's on your form. And their argument is, or the Court of Appeals holding is, whether he had the power to do this, whether he was violating his divorce decree by doing this, is not an issue of form. That's an issue of substance. And so let's assume sometime later, apparently at the summary judgment hearing, those problems go away, the divorce decree problems go away. Under the policy, isn't that named beneficiary changed effective the day he signed it?
That's what the
policy says, right?
Justice Brewster, your point about at some time later invokes a hindsight approach, which is not allowed.
Well, but I mean, contracts all the time say people sign them afterward and say it's effective 3 months ago.
Okay, and what we should look at, should we not, is what the insurance company was faced with at the time, and that is conflicting beneficiary designations made by this very insured. Ed Martinez, on September 28, 1994, had made his prior designation, quote, in accordance with the divorce decree, putting State Farm on notice that there's not just a divorce decree, but a judgment out there.
But if he had kept living, and all these problems have been worked out, and so she waives her rights as she did here later at the summary judgment hearing while he was still alive. Would you have treated her as the named beneficiary as of when the problems were cleared up or as of when he signed it?
As of when he signed it. Once the problems were cleared up, absolutely the request would have been valid as of when he submitted the request. And that's exactly why State Farm returned his change request, saying, please give us either court documentation or consent by the ex-wife to remove her as beneficiary of record. What happened next? He died unexpectedly while vacationing in the British Columbia. And within days after the insured passed away, State Farm was faced with not one, not two, but three conflicting claims made to the same proceeds. And it is important to note that the claim filed by the ex-wife, Linda, was not conditional. It was a complete claim for the $500,000. So State Farm was faced with three conflicting claims that presented reasonable doubt.
Well, why not interplead then instead of the, as I understand it, three-week delay?
It was actually a 12-day delay. What State Farm did, and this is part of the court's record, is sent letters. State Farm acknowledged all three of the claims, as it should do under 2155, under the statute applicable at the time. No, there's been no dispute that State Farm didn't acknowledge all the claims properly and wrote to all the parties and said, all three of you have filed conflicting claims. Linda, the ex-wife, is the beneficiary of record, but we also recognize that Lisa, the adult daughter, has also filed a claim and that Tony, the surviving spouse, has filed a claim. What State Farm did, and this is undisputed, is encourage settlement among the parties and said, if you don't resolve your differences, we're going to file an interpleader. In fact, there are at least two letters in which State Farm sent letters to the parties, all three parties, and said, if you don't file your differences, we will file an interpleader. We're going to file an interpleader, and that's precisely what State Farm did.
Are there other questions? I see your time has expired. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from you on the rebuttal. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Payne will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Bill Payne, and this is the first opportunity I've had to appear before this court in quite a long time. I'm in the twilight of my career, and in the twilight you begin to have physical problems, one of which is my hearing. And I'm attempting to adjust these hearing aids, and I hope I can hear you and not screech above. I want to please, as a trial lawyer of some time, explain to you that I think we should look at the big picture first, and then I want to get to specifics with you. We've got a situation in which we've got a statute enacted by the legislature that makes insurance companies promptly settle claims so as to eliminate the stress. All of that on widows and persons who are left after death that would otherwise be on this fork of uncertainty that would be created by insurers who should not keep people on forks of uncertainty and create stress in the lives of widows.
I agree with that. The problem is, in this case, they wanted y'all to work it out. Let's assume there was... they had a right to interplead all along because there's these conflicting claims, and we'll understand the counterarguments on that. But so we're down to day 59. If they put it into the court, they're going to have to hire an attorney. They're going to have to pay an attorney's fees, and the law on interpleaders clear. They get their attorney's fees out of the corpus. If they can get you all to agree without that, they don't have to hire that attorney. So, in effect, by waiting 12 days, if we tell them, sorry, you should have done it earlier, aren't we hurting beneficiaries of the policy? Because we're saying, don't even try to work it out, throw it into court, take some attorney's fees out of it in every case.
Justice, please let me delay that just a bit and get back to the big picture.
Okay.
Fundamentally, this case does not upset the law of the state of Texas about applying the penalties, nor does it affect adversely the law giving them the right in a proper case to interplead. The most fundamental thing about the right of interpleader is that the person that interpleads must be innocent. I tell you what, I frankly think it takes a whale of a lawyer to get up here and stand before people like this and say State Farm's innocent. they breached the very fundamental concept of their insurance policy. They've got a policy with Ed Martinez. They took his dollar and promised to pay whoever he said to pay, $500,000, and we will pay it to whomever you designate. Well, and it's effective immediately.
There is this, there's no question his designation that he sent him on August 1st violated his divorce decree.
Okay, wait a minute. Let me talk about the insurance policy, and then
no,
I'm going to talk
no,
about
no, no, no. We got 16 minutes left, and I want an answer to that question. There is no question when he sent him on August 1st, change my beneficiary, that violated his divorce decree.
Absolutely not.
I'm looking at it here, and it says, so long as Ed maintains Linda as a beneficiary an amount sufficient to pay, he can name as beneficiary for the remainder whomever he chooses. So where was the policy naming Linda as a beneficiary on August 2nd?
Judge, now listen. As I argue, sometimes I inject humor. What is the definition of irrevocable? That means it can't be changed. If, in fact, I have once designated Linda, the lady who was to be protected by my contract, her security interest, I've done that, do I have to do it again? If it is irrevocable, Your Honor, I don't care what I do later. Could I change it if I once have irrevocably designated her? Okay, give me a moment. Judge, the agreement incident to divorce only has this insurance policy involved because we, with regard to the contract that Ed made with his ex-wife, was attempted pursuant to his contractual ability to give her contractual alimony. In order to give her the additional security that whatever happens to me in my future life,
I know the facts.
Okay, you're to have the security.
I know. The policy says, though, he has to maintain her as a beneficiary.
Exactly, in an amount sufficient.
So, if he changed her on this policy, where is she still maintained as a beneficiary in amount sufficient to pay $120,000?
She was irrevocably designated way back up the way. If she's been irrevocably designated, the designation that he made didn't change the irrevocable designation to give Linda the security.
You mean when he signed her originally on this policy as an irrevocable beneficiary?
Yes, sir.
Oh, so he was just wasting his time sending in a change of beneficiary on August 1st because it wouldn't do anything.
No, sir. He's designating who he wants to have the policy proceeds. The policy proceeds are $500,000, and that's the meat of the coconut. Linda, the ex-wife, never had the right to these policy proceeds. She only had the right for these proceeds to be held to give her the $5,000 a month if, in fact, she fulfilled the conditions of not dying and not remarrying and so forth.
Let me ask that question this way. If Linda was taken off the $500,000 policy, under the agreement incident to divorce, could either of the other two policies have sufficed to provide payments to Linda in satisfaction of the AID?
Okay, Justice, let me get to that this way. I think that's
Isn't that a yes or a no question?
Okay,
I mean, he had a $175,000 policy in addition to the $500,000 policy and a $125,000 policy. As I understand it, there's $120,000 left in obligation on the contractual
Correct.
Alimony. So either of those other two policies still would have satisfied the obligation to pay Linda, correct? So he could have taken her off the $500,000 policy and it still would not have violated the agreement incident to divorce. That's the question.
Okay, sir. I don't believe because I think there had already been changes on the $175,000 policy.
Well, so there was still the $125,000 policy. Given what you just said, that's true. There was still the $125,000 policy. Wouldn't that have satisfied the AID?
This policy, the $500,000, with regard to fulfilling and being security for her $120,000, Tony made her claim by letter September the 10th. 8 days later, Okay. State Farm has got to, in order to enter plea, they've got to have a reasonable doubt. We're on the horns of a dilemma. We've got a claim here. The claim of Linda was only for 120. On September the 18th, the letter to State Farm by me said, here, let me spell it out for you. Here's what the aide gives Linda. It only gives Linda $5,000 a month if she doesn't die or remarry. The maximum amount is 120. It can be held for security. There is literally no claim whatsoever that Linda has to 380.
That's not what Linda was saying, though.
Right. Sir?
That's not what Linda was saying.
Okay, let's go there. Let's go there. Okay, I claim I own the Golden Gate Bridge.
Well, you know, that's not a reasonable claim, though. The claim that was presented here seems to be reasonable. And I think, for me, it goes back to the simple question that Justice Brister asked in the beginning. Isn't it better to allow this type of proceeding than to have these attorney's fees paid out of the corpus so that there's more money paid to the beneficiary as opposed to attorneys?
Judge, in a proper case where there is a reasonable claim, the procedure of interpleader, I don't challenge. Here, Judge, we've got a situation where Linda's claim was what she had under the agreement incident to divorce. Period. And it does not take a rocket scientist to read that deal and know, Linda, you don't have a claim for $500,000. Because when I designated Linda, Ed designated Linda, Mr. Insurance Company, Linda has the right under the agreement incident to divorce. And she does not have the right to $500,000. She has the right to $5,000 a month.
Well, let me suggest, though, that it doesn't appear from the record to me that State Farm was trying to be an advocate on behalf of one beneficiary or a proposed beneficiary or another. It had competing claims, and it wasn't going to act as the judge and decide all the legal issues. And there was no question that the money was going to be paid. I mean, there was no dispute about that. And so what State Farm did is what most people faced with that situation would do, interplead the funds. And it doesn't seem to me like they did that in opposition to your client or in favor of any other beneficiary, but at some point just said, okay, here's the money, and you three litigate to whom it's entitled.
Judge, I so totally and thoroughly disagree.
Well,
if you were to walk a mile in my moccasins and see what has occurred, you would indeed know differently. With regard to what I want to tell you, with regard to State Farm's actions, State Farm's actions in this particular case has been litigated. They've lofted all the balloons, whirl. We've got a claim. Linda's claiming the whole $5,000, and I just don't know what to do. With regard to me claiming the Golden Gate, that's what I would like. Linda's claim to the $5,000, because Linda's only claim is the aid. We do not need rocket scientists. I begged to talk to their lawyers to tell them what Linda's right was and that they need not be perplexed by Linda's claim. Linda doesn't claim the whole thing. She just said, I make my claim.
How much did Lisa claim?
She didn't say. She just filled out a claim. My rights under the policy. And the designation said Linda is a beneficiary pursuant to my divorce decree. You read the divorce decree to see what Linda's claim is.
Counsel, as you've said, you've been around the block several times. Do you agree with Chief Justice Pope's statement in Sanders that an insurance company should not be compelled to act as judge and jury?
Without a doubt. I don't have any quarrel with that.
But you don't see any claims here that would lead a reasonable insurer to submit the funds to a court pending resolution of the disputes?
With regard to the cases that speak about whether or not the person that wishes to interplead is faced with doubt. Judge, the cases all say the doubt's got to be reasonable. You've got to look at the circumstances to determine whether or not the person that wishes to interplead, if in fact you've got the craziest claims in the world, and then the interplead, I'm protected by interpleader because I had different claims. The fact that the cases say just because you've got a claim doesn't give you a right to skate the interpleader. You've got to analyze these things, and in this particular case, the rights of Linda were so clear as to not to entitle her to the policy proceeds. And what is important, 8 days after we made our claim to the policy, we wrote to them. We told them we acknowledge Linda's rights. We think that there is no claim whatsoever that anybody has to $380. The expression by Ed Martinez to designate his wife was the last expression before his death that he made as to who he wanted the policy. Therefore, there was no claim whatsoever as to $380,000.
Counsel, let me ask you a question then. If you believe, I understand that who the fund should be paid to is crystal clear.
I do.
Why would an insurer interplead the funds if it was crystal clear and they could just write a check? Why would they not just do that if it was so perfectly clear from their perspective?
Well, I suppose.
I mean, what's the motivation for not doing it?
Well, now then, you're beginning to get me into big dollars that I don't quite understand. But big dollars in State Farm.
Well, your position begs the question.
If they keep 500 here, and if they keep 500 there, and in the state of Texas, with regard to claims of widows that want their money and they won't State Farm to pay, if they can delay at 59, I don't know how much interest you earn on millions and millions and millions. But there would be a lot of financial incentive for you not to get your claims paid when there is no doubt about who the money's owed to.
So not favoring one party or another, you think it could be a matter of interest earned?
Without a doubt.
Well, that's a compelling argument, and the statute, I think, was maybe perhaps designed to protect that, but it still brings us back to the very first question Justice Brister asked, and maybe you've answered. I just don't get it yet. But the purpose of the interpleader is, it seems to me, it's better for the parties to settle the matter, as I understand State Farm tried to get the parties to do.
Well, let me suppose to you, Judge, did this. Our friendly settlement motivator, they suggest to me and to this widow, why don't you just give Linda $120,000. That'd be a good settlement, wouldn't it? When I'm representing her and I read the law and I say this man, that was his policy and he could designate who gets the money and his widow was supposed to get the money, and I know good and well I can read English and I can read the aid and I can see Linda isn't entitled to $1 if his estate continues to make the $5,000 payment.
But at the summary judgment hearing, you and Linda's lawyer agreed. You got $380,000, and she got a lien on $120,000.
Okay, let me characterize that.
Isn't that right?
He recognized and agreed that that was the case.
Now, y'all could have worked that out in the first 60 days, too. I mean, in other words, State Farm wasn't the only one delaying. You all could have reached that same agreement back during the 60 days at the settlement. There never would have been any interpleader. There never would have been a deduction for State Farm's lawyer's fees on the interpleader. We never would have had an appeal.
Okay, Judge, let me answer in this respect. I believe so strongly, and I don't mean to offend, Wade, when I believe in something, I'm not politically correct. This money belongs to this man's widow. And I didn't need Linda to agree or not to agree as to what she had. I knew what she had because I can read.
And she didn't have all $500,000.
Exactly.
She did not have all $500,000.
Absolutely not.
Right. She had $380,000.
She had.
I'm sorry, the other way around. Your client had. Your client had the $380,000, and Linda had a right to tie up $120,000.
To tie up. She only had the right to tie it up as payments were made from the estate.
Well, see, I don't understand your argument that my client's entitled to all $500 if she's got a right to tie up $120. I mean, those are inconsistent. I think.
Well, Judge, under the aid, Linda is entitled to $5,000 a month. And she's not really entitled to $120,000. She's entitled to $5,000 a month, because if she remarries, she's through. She doesn't get anything more. So all we've got here, we have got total monies, the proceeds of the policy, that should go to the person that Ed Martinez said, I want to have the money. But there is an asterisk by some of this. It's going to be in a vault over here to protect Linda. But if Linda gets what she is contractually supposed to get from the estate, every month $5,000 is freed and goes. So with regard to saying Linda has the right to this, I suppose it's semantics, Judge, but in my mind, there's no doubt that it's the widow's, and it's subject only to being held pending the payment.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question. Not your case, but in another case. Same agreement incident to divorce, except the estate's bankrupt. And the estate's not going to be able to pay $5,000 in interest, $5,000 a month, for the remaining time period, and the remaining 2 years. Same thing, the bankrupt insured shortly before his death says, give it all to my new wife. And the insurance company knows about the agreement incident to divorce. If the insurance company go ahead and change the beneficiary and then upon death sends all the money to the named beneficiary, does the former wife have a claim against the insurer for paying out funds that she had a beneficial interest in?
Excuse me, I got a little lost.
It's basically your case, but if there hadn't been any way to pay $5,000 a month for the next 2 years, if Ed had been bankrupt when he died, and they had done what you asked, which is pay it all to current wife, would Linda have had a claim against the insurer for paying out money that I had a beneficial interest and should have been tied up for me, and now I'm out $120,000 and I want State Farm to pay it?
Okay, you're spreading me a little thin there, because I think you're starting to get me into third-party beneficiary rights with regard to contracts. We've got two contracts. This contract...
No, it's really the same as an interpleader. I'm a stakeholder, and if I'm on notice of somebody's claim, beneficial, equitable, whatever it is, and I pay it out, I might have to pay it twice, might I not?
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm a little bit nervous, and I'm having trouble, but I want to tell you, all that is negated by the fact that on September the 18th, we wrote a letter to State Farm. You don't have any exposure. You don't have any problem, because we know she's got the right, and we agree that we're going to escrow $120,000. So there wasn't any doubt in their mind. They weren't exposed to a claim that exposed them to liability.
But Linda didn't agree with you Did Linda agree with that statement you just made at any time before the summary judgment hearing?
I do not believe so. But may I ask, please, there's a guy that frustrated me in law school, right? And he talked about what you call it, the Socratic method, about you know, asking questions. And I never knew the answer to the question, therefore I didn't learn anything about constitutional law. But my question to you is, what difference does Linda's agreement make? I don't have to have Linda's agreement. Linda's got what she's got. And I don't have to have an agreement with Linda. The person that had the dollars was State Farm. And I had the agreement with State Farm. I fully recognize what she's got a right to. And you don't have any exposure because I agree. So I don't have to have Linda's agreement.
I had Professor Wright, too, and when he said the class is over, it was over.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure, and I hope I have not offended.
May it please the Court. Mr. Skelton will present the rebuttal for the petition.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Mr. Chief Justice, I also had Professor Wright, and he confounded me as well. If I could try to get to the very heart of the question of should State Farm have immediately implemented the change request, I think we have to look at that change request in context of what else was in State Farm's file. If it merely had in its file a designation of Linda, And then it got a designation of new lifetime.
Well, you don't agree it was a mistake not to just, according to the policy, make the change.
Couldn't have done so. And the reason it couldn't have done so is that in the context of what was already in the file, which was a designation not just of Linda, but of Linda as irrevocable pursuant to a court order, then the new designation change, the change to Tony, was an incomplete document. It conflicted with a prior designation, and the insurance company could not have taken on the risk of trying to do what Sanders says it does not have to do, which is go back and investigate, determine what is true and what is not.
Would it have made a difference if the other side were to send you a letter of indemnification, essentially saying cut the entire check to his client, we'll indemnify you for any action that this other third party may pursue against you?
That would then have become a business decision on State Farm's part, Justice Medina, as to whether it wanted to be complicit in violating a court order, knowing that, well, at least I'm indemnified, and then it would have to look behind the creditworthiness of the indemnitor. What would have made a difference is if the second change, now there was a prior change in the $175,000 policy, in which Ed did the correct thing, as Ms. Ramos has told us, in which he said, and here is ex-wife's agreement. Well, then State Farm felt, fine, now you have answered my questions. But what would have been better is if the $500,000 policy change had also been accompanied by consent of Linda. And conspicuously, that consent was not there. What did State Farm do immediately? It did what any prudent insurer should do and what our law should encourage it to do. It immediately wrote back on August 16 and said, essentially, this is an incomplete change request. And the policy doesn't call it a demand. It's a request. It's a request that must be in a form that we accept. And this request is incomplete because of this divorce decree you previously sent us, Ed. Ed, you sent us a divorce decree telling us we had to reserve the policy for the alimony payments to the ex-wife, and now you've sent us an incomplete request.
So what do we do with the 60-day deadline? How do we decide when is too much beyond it, when is not too much beyond it, and how do you address counsel's concerns about there's a certain ability to play the market here a little bit by saying we're facilitating settlement, we can hold the funds a little bit longer?
For one thing, we didn't do that.
We
tendered the money with interest, and that's in the record. But here's how you address that. We have a statute, and we have a statute that has been interpreted and been interpreted by the courts. And the common law has created an exception to 2155. That's what Sanders says. It creates an exception. And Sanders, which should have been binding on the 10th Court, very clearly says what the standard was. Is the period of delay before interpleading, quote, so unreasonable as to justify imposition of a statutory penalty? So we've got the standard. And the standard acknowledges, and I think something that's been lost here today, is what's been imposed on State Farm is penal in nature. It's a penalty.
Was it
so unreasonable? So what you do to answer Justice O'Neill's question, you look at the record and you say, was trying to get the parties to agree, trying to get not a deduction from the corpus, an unreasonable thing? Or was the 12 days as reasonable as the 45 days, the 30 days, the more than those days in other cases? I apologize, Judge.
The legislature's the ones that imposed the penalty, though.
Absolutely.
Okay, so when we're arguing about penalty, you need to go over there and argue about that. So what we're arguing about here, your position is that we look at the reasonableness of the delay?
We look at the reasonableness of the delay under Sanders because that is the prevailing standard. And what the legislature did was...
So looking at this timeline, let me short circuit. Looking at the timeline that we have here, September the 11th, we have all the claims in hand. And then October the 1st, 20 days later, you write a letter and say, we may have to do an interplea. And then we have a short space, but actually you have another from October the 1st until November the 10th, and there's nothing in here. And then on the 19th, you pay, and on the 27th, you file an interplea. So what do we have to judge this, the reasonableness by... when it doesn't show any action between October the 1st, when you say we may have to file an interpleader, and November the 10th comes and goes, and then on the 19th you did that. What Is there something in the record to explain that? How do we know
why
the legislature doesn't mean what it says?
Well, the legislature means what it says because it repeatedly reenacted the statute, and it reenacted the statute, and Duenas says the legislature must be regarded as intending the statute when repeatedly reenacted to be given the interpretation it has been given by the courts, and the courts have given it Sanders. And
Duenas is not on all fours with this case.
It's not on all fours, but it is a guide to the fact that we have a repeatedly reenacted statute, and we have an exception, a common law exception, to the statute.
Yeah,
and
what
the legislature and so to answer the justice's question, during that time period, that the record is clear that letters were written and efforts were made. It's undisputed they were trying to resolve the case by settlement. And an insurance company hiring a lawyer, getting an interpleader on file, doesn't happen in 3 days.
Well, but you had 40 days here, it looks to me like, between October the 1st when you say you may have to do an interpleader and November the 10th isn't that 40 days?
Well, it's undisputed that that was the period of time in which they convened a settlement conference and tried to get the parties to settle, and they couldn't.
You knew you had a problem all that time. So how do we say it's not unreasonable to go 19 days, but how do we know the 40 days is reasonable and the extra 10 or 15 or 7 or whatever is not? I mean, you had all the facts in front of you, looks to me like.
The only thing you can do is look at the case law. And the case law is 41 days, 45 days, and longer periods of time than the 12th year to be reasonable, and look at the standard in Sanders, which is the only thing we had to go on until this court issues its opinion. And the standard in Sanders is, was it so unreasonable as to justify payment?
How long
in this case, it was not.
How long does it take for an insurance company to hire a lawyer and file an appeal?
It takes this insurance company a while to hire a lawyer to get one
more file. More than 3 days?
It certainly does.
How long does it take for any party to go file a mandamus? Do that rather minutes, right?
Judge, could we have done it sooner? Absolutely. State Farm could have done this quicker. But did it act unreasonably? And the answer is no in the area of the prevailing case law. And I cut off, Justice O'Neill. I apologize. I was answering another question. Is there something I can answer?
Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oye, oye, oye. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.